Okay. All right. Hi, everybody. So we're going to talk about viruses that are associated with cancers. So, I'm using the careful English term of associated, not cause, because in a lot of the cases, it's been very, very difficult to prove direct causality, even though we're fairly sure that there's a cause. And as we go along, you'll see what I mean. Association is much easier. So, for example, I set these, well, it's very loud, set these into three groups here, carcinomas, lymphomas, and sarcomas. So the majority of tumors in humans anyway are carcinomas of epithelial origin. And so clearly, any virus that would be associated or in some way causative of this, or at least participating in this, should be able to infect that target cell. So we're going to talk about lots of these, human papillomavirus and so on and so forth. We'll get into all these different groups. And lymphomas, again, these are of specific lymphocyte lineages, for example, B cell lymphomas in Epstein-Barr virus-related so-called liquid tumors, lymphomas. And again, the Epstein-Barr virus, by definition, would have to infect those target cells. And if they didn't, then we'd have a hard time even linking causality. And then something that is probably now getting to its 15th year, getting close to 20 years as a phenomenon of the discovery of a new herpes virus called HHV-8, which originally was called Kaposi sarcomavirus, but actually is a herpes virus family, and that's involved with this sarcoma called Kaposi sarcoma. We'll talk about that a little bit. It's actually not that much a sarcoma as it is a hyperplasia. Okay. The point of this graph here, table, is to show you the difference between developed countries, so that's, let's say, Europe, for the most part, Europe and the United States, some parts of South America, just to give you the impact of what these things may be in certain places. So, for example, the liver cancer associated with human hepatitis B virus and hepatitis C virus, this is already from several years ago, so these number of cases are relatively low. And again, showing that it's low in the percentage of cancer, but now if you go into larger developing countries, you can see actually that the impact is very, very high. And as a percentage of the total cases of cancer that they see, period, you know, it's eightfold higher. So I think that was the point I was trying to tell you, that that depending on where it is in HPV, which gives you roughly 80,000 cases of cervical cancer a year in the United States and Europe, it's much larger and a higher percentage of the total number of cancer cases outside those areas. So it depends where you look. Here's the final cumulative number of, so over 25% may be associated with one or more viruses outside the US and Europe. Very important number. Means there's a big impact. So why is this important, beside the fact that there is interesting that we have these things? So clearly, if this is a viral etiology, if the virus is either the direct cause or a participant, a cofactor in inducing this cancer, then if we have vaccines and we can eliminate that agent or suppress its ability to replicate and produce more viruses, a loose term we call viremia, where there's less amount of virus in the blood, then you could prevent or treat or ameliorate the symptoms. Diagnosis. It's relatively easy to diagnose this, because now if you say this case of cervical cancer was HPV positive, as opposed to HPV negative, there's in the clinicians and the pathologists a much more direct means of figuring out how that cancer came about, as opposed to one that was not induced by HPV. Again, more treatment business. This is like the prevention. You have antivirals, in some cases antibiotics. Of course, antibiotics do not work with viruses, but there are some bacteria, we haven't talked about them, that are also involved in a much, much lower frequency with incidence of cancer, but nothing directly as a causative. And the one that I don't think we have any slides to talk about is gastric cancer and Helicobacter pylori. Again, everybody should read some article about this, because this is a classic example of people who felt they were right. It was a clinician and a researcher who partnered in Australia. They felt they were right. And for many, many years, last hundred years, science said that you got ulcers because you had too much acid in your stomach, and so the antacid business was massive. They said, no, we're finding this bacteria that is coincident with the cases of gastric cancer. They fought, they were suppressed by the establishment until it became obvious that they were correct. They eventually got the Nobel Prize. Great story, so if you're right, stick to your guns. Okay, so again, mechanism. If there's a viral etiology, we can know how the virus is producing some sort of proteins which may be causing immortalization of the cell, transformation of the cell, things that we talked about before in regards to oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. And then if there's a viral etiology, and as I just mentioned before, in certain parts of the world, there's a higher incidence of this, then it becomes an important medical global problem that has to be dealt with in a concerted way. All right. So here's an example. Let's get back to the principles of, before we get to the virus, let's get back to the principles of cell cycle. So again, cancer is a disease of two things. Number one, genetics, and how those gene products, which are controlling lots of the proliferation, growth, survival, metabolism, behavior of a cell. And since growth and proliferation are two of the largest hallmarks in cancer, so just to review that you have cells, when they're proliferating, they come out of a quiescent phase of G0, they go into G1, and they now prepare and express genes which turn on S phase, where there's DNA replication, and therefore at the end of G1 you have to have both regulatory genes and products that are directly involved with DNA replication itself. Okay, so now you have DNA replication. And then G2M, M of course is mitosis, so G2M is now the cell preparing with spindle and so on to divide, so now you've taken the double DNA and now divide it into what are going to become the daughter cells. So that's a regular cell cycle. Here's your, start with a single cell, you end up getting these two daughter cells. The point is that most of the, as we talked about before, most of the oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes work at this G1S transition, because this is the first and biggest regulatory hurdle in any cell cycle, and this is where cancer cells, of course, have evolved with mutations and so on in order to get around the normal controls, normal checkpoints. There are checkpoints here too, but you got to get over this bigger hump. And so P53 and RB are two tumor suppressors that are very involved with regulating, with putting on the brakes, if you will, progression, abnormal progression from G1 to S. Okay, so in other words, it tells the cell after it's been treated or bathed with some sort of growth factor or initiation factor to start going through G1 and make enough stuff just to go through one cycle of your replication. And that cycle should be this long in time. And if this is messed up, if these are mutated or downregulated or deleted in the tumor cell, now you're sort of rushing through very quickly, and you often don't have a stop, you just keep going around and around and around. And that's part of what happens in the cancer cell. So let's break this down a little bit more, which is RB, when it's hyperphosphorylated, so more phosphate, so this makes it look like there's no phosphorylation on regular RB. Even active RB has phosphorylation, but when Arby's hyperphosphorylated. And how does it get hyperphosphorylated? You have all these combinations of so-called cyclins and their paired kinases, cyclin-dependent kinases, CDKs. And there's different combinations and so on. So the two big ones that are involved with G1S transition are cyclin D, CDK4 or 6, and cyclin E, CDK2. All right? Somewhat of a simplification, but it works. And cyclin A, CDK2 is very involved in continuing through S phase. So these combinations of cyclin CDKs activate the CDKs. They can hyperphosphorylate RB. And when that's hyperphosphorylated, what happens is that RB can no longer block transcription that is directed by E2F family of factors. And so it basically doesn't bind here, so it can't knock off the E2F. And therefore, this transcription, when RB is active, is binding here and blocking the transcription. When it's not active, when it's hyperphosphorylated, it will not bind, E2F stays, and now it turns out to be E2F family members are positive transcription factors. You have transcription of genes very much involved with S phase, like DNA replication genes and so on, and now you get DNA replication. Here's a simple example of how viruses can overcome this. So adenoviruses have many, many different serotypes, but there are some of the serotypes which are involved, especially in the animal kingdom and a little bit in humans, that they're associated with certain cancers. For example, in humans, they're associated with nasopharyngeal carcinoma, so cancers up here, but not everywhere in the world. It's mostly in Asia, China, and Vietnam, and so on. And so it's thought that there must be a genetic background to those populations, plus these strains of adenovirus, and now you have higher incidences of nasopharyngeal carcinoma. One of the ways that adenovirus might do this is they make a protein called E1A. It's an early protein called, that's why it's E, and made early in the virus infection. So E1A binds directly to RB and inactivates it on its own. So if you forget about the phosphorylation up here, if you just bind it and prevent it from binding to this promoter site that's already engaged by E2F, so now it's inhibiting its function, and now you can have transcription of S phase genes, and then you get proteins, and now you get cell cycle progression. So that's a very simplistic way, but it's one of the ways that viruses can interrupt this process. So let's get to P53 for a second. So P53 is, and again, this is highly simplified, as you've seen some of the signaling lectures. But here are the main points, that P53 can control apoptosis by controlling all sorts of proteins that are controlling proteins themselves that control caspases and other apoptosis-regulating proteins. It can be affected by kinases ATM and ATR, which actually are part of the G2M checkpoint, so later in the cell cycle. If there was DNA damage, these proteins get upregulated and activated, and now they can say, wait a minute, if we still have P53, if the cell is normal, not a cancer cell, we have P53, we put the brakes on, we have to wait, checkpoint, wait, until we fix these mutations, and then we can go forward. And if we can't fix these mutations, we go into apoptosis. That's the normal checkpoint. But if you've removed P53, you take away that checkpoint, and now you can, this DNA damage can be not fixed, and the cell cycle can continue. And that's one of the reasons why the cancer cells collect mutations. Senescence. So you should know that cells, either in our body or in the plate, have a finite number of cell divisions. Of course, once we put them in the plate, they have fewer than in our body. But even in our body, they have a finite number. That is to say that this type of cell will proliferate X number of times and then eventually poop out. That's pretty simple. That's senescence. So it's a fancy way of saying cell aging. This is part and parcel of our aging and so on and so forth. So again, if you don't have P53, you ruin that checkpoint in order for the cell to say, normally I should be dying because I'm getting very old and that's part of my senescence. Instead, the cell continues to proliferate or stay around and may sustain more mutations as it ages, and again, more pro-cancerous issues. How P53 can control other aspects of MYC or RAS controlled proliferation. So P53 is really, really central. So if you mess up P53, again, you're going to mess up these controls of normal replication and survival. The last point I want to make about general controls that the cell has, especially human cells, are lengths of the ends of the chromosomes called telomeres. It is a well-known phenomenon for decades that as cells, or as we age, you take cells from aging people, and you look at their chromosomes, the length of the telomeres shorten over time. And it is believed that once they get down to a certain smaller level, that brings chromosomal instability, which again leads to normally the cell going through lots of senescence and then dying. But if cancer cells have gotten around that checkpoint, then they can now survive longer. One of the ways they do this is by producing an enzyme telomerase, which makes the telomeres. They can overexpress these in cancer, and this leads to maintenance of the long telomere length. And so, again, the cell is outliving its normal use, right? By the way, we often use telomerase or overexpress telomerase in a cell just to immortalize it. We take a cell out from a person, you know, from an organ, a normal cell, we want to make a normal cell line, we'll introduce telomerase. It's not a cancer cell, but it continues to proliferate, it's immortalized. So if you mess up this system also by a virus, then you're also going to now lead to more chance of cancer. All right. So let's do a compare and contrast between classic carcinogens. These are agents, either chemicals or radiation, that is now doing a direct damaging of the DNA. And some of them are quite specific to types of damage they do, versus viruses as carcinogens, viruses that come in and now mess up some of these processes I just explained in a very general way. All right, so virus side, chemical side. So for example, viruses usually have to introduce foreign DNA, should be said foreign DNA or RNA, in other words, their nucleic acid. And it's often the gene product of those viral genes, which is now messing with the normal systems and pathways. Whereas in chemicals and radiations, you have a direct direct mutation and direct damage to the DNA of the host. Okay, there's no damage here per se when you bring in a viral RNA or DNA. Usually, in order to get cancer, that virus, let's just say DNA virus for the meantime, if it's a DNA type of virus, that DNA usually has to stay, or at least most of that DNA, has to stay in that cell for the life of the cancer that's going to grow. Now, there are examples where, and they're exceptional, where people have found, they think they have this etiological agent, a viral agent, they could find the DNA or RNA, and then later as the tumor grows, it's not there. So they call this a hit-and-run type of carcinogenesis by this virus, meaning that it may have been involved early on with the initiation, but as you have selection for more malignancy, you actually select against that cell retaining the viral DNA. But for the most part, the persistence is a pretty good idea. In other words, if you just had a transient virus infection where the RNA or DNA was there for 48 hours, it's highly unlikely that you'd be able to get cancer, because the point is you have to continue to make the viral RNAs and protein products. So chemicals are all by definition hit and run. You treat, you know, for a certain amount of time, and it does its damage, and you don't have to continue treating with that. The damage is done, and if that damage is sustained, that mutation or chromosomal break or translocation is sustained to the daughter cells, that's all you need. You don't need the chemical to keep doing that, right? That is not to say and it's quick. So in many cases, people are subjected to these chemicals over the years. Does everybody know about Love Canal? Who doesn't know about Love Canal? All right. When you get home, Google Love Canal. We are 14 miles from Love Canal. So does everybody know that we are 14 miles from the first Superfund cleanup site in the United States? And if you read about it, you'll read what was legal at the time to dump toxic chemicals into what was a canal that some guy had an idea would be a tourist attraction for little boats so people didn't have to get scared about the Niagara Falls. That didn't work, so there were all these chemical companies, as anybody who's been to Niagara Falls knows, and so they wanted to dump these chemicals, so they dumped it into the trough, which was the canal, and then filled over, and then that became a nice little real estate area, and then there were high cases of abortion, high cases of miscarriages, high cases of, you know, skin damage, etc., etc. Everybody should read about it, because we're living 14 miles from there. So, hit and run, but that hitting could be for quite a long time. All right, here's again my point that I keep saying, continued expression of viral genes is necessary. Not required for the continuous presence, even though, as I said, in many cases, some carcinogens, you know, if you had one shot of asbestos, it's almost impossible to get lung cancer. On the other hand, if you've had asbestos for many, many years, now you have the irritation that leads to the type of cancer that's involved with that. All right. Here, you're talking about sometimes a single viral gene, several viral genes expressed. And again, that's highly specific. It's mechanistic per virus. And here, it's random. Even though the carcinogen may be the type that only alkylates the DNA, or if it's a type of radiation, for example, UV radiation makes thymidine dimers, makes two thymidines next to each other dimerize. It's a very specific thing. So it could be specific for the effect, but it's not specific for where it is in the DNA. It's just random anywhere. So it's not hitting necessarily an important gene or not a gene. All right, so let's start talking about some of these viruses, oncoproteins, what they do. Now, again, the theme of attacking RB and P53 seems to be very prevalent. And for scientists to look at this, having studied these viruses and see this, it basically says to us, if we didn't think so before, we should now begin to think that P53 and RB are pretty important genes in our genome for, you know, normal control. All right, so we have polyomaviruses. This is an example of SV40, which is not in humans. SV40 is simian virus 40, that is primates but not humans. And then this is another related virus which does infect humans, and this is associated with a Merkel cell cancer, which is a sort of rare lymphoma, but it's a polyomavirus in that family. They make two types of antigens, large T and small T. I mean, this was in the primitive days, so one was a larger protein and one was a smaller protein, so they call it large and small, okay? But, you know, this is that stuff, large T antigen, small T antigen. These guys bind to P53 and RB directly, and lead to the degradation of those proteins. Therefore, a cell that's expressing this and these antigens are effectively P53 and RB negative. So they're immortalized, but they're also all the processes that I just gave you, some of them, that are controlled by P53 and RB are now exposed to the next mutational hit that could be in an oncogene, right? So these cells are immortalized but very susceptible to cancer. Papillomavirus, now we're going to get into the strains and so on later because there's many, many different strains of these things. But some of them, to some extent, the ones that are causing cancer in humans, that's mostly cervical carcinoma, have two proteins, E6 and E7, but now, whereas large T or small T bind both, each protein binds both, E6 binds P53, E7 binds PRB. So now it's split it. The virus has made two proteins, one hits P53, one hits RB. Same effect in the long run. And the strains of papillomavirus which cause cancer have these guys that bind to these P53NRV. The ones that don't cause cancer but cause hyperplasia, like a wart that you might have on your finger, plantar's wart, are very weak binders to P53NRV, or in fact probably don't bind to them well at all. Right, that's the trick. Now, there are other viruses, like papillomaviruses, in nature, which make other proteins that are unrelated. It's called E5. Again, when you see E, that's called an early protein in a viral replication. Viruses have a life cycle like humans, but usually we divide the proteins into immediate early, early, and late. Again, simplify. So here, another early protein, E5, very different than these guys. This one binds the PDGF receptor, which is a growth factor receptor found in, you know, just about every cell, not every cell, but just about every cell in the body. So if you bind to that and inactivate that receptor, you've killed off, if you will, a growth factor pathway. That often leads to the favoring of another pathway, and when those mechanisms come up, now that really takes it. Even though this is, there's no cows dying over this, I promise you. Adenovirus, as I mentioned before, there are many, many strains of adenovirus. I showed you E1A before. E1A binds to RB, but they make a separate protein again, E1B, and that binds to P53. Same thing as human papillomavirus. Epstein-Barr viruses, now we get into a whole different thing. Epstein-Barr, you remember, are not making solid tumors, they're making B-cell lymphomas. Different cell, different biology, different, you know, apples and oranges of what is required for its cell cycle. So Epstein-Barr virus is making all sorts of viral proteins, which are effectively doing two things. The main thing I wanted, the traps we're not going to get into, but two things that, let's go to the bottom first. It now can prevent B cells, B lymphocytes, from senescing. So they become immortalized, and they now go through permanent regeneration. They're almost like a stem cell, not quite. So B cells normally in your body make antibodies. And when your B cells become activated to plasma cells, they spew out a lot of antibodies, but just in a very short life cycle, maybe several days. A plasma cell's life is just several days. But prior to that activation, there's a stage prior to that, to plasma cell, where the B cell will produce a regenerating stem cell, not a pluripotent stem cell, it's just a very short-term stem cell, which just makes more of that set that has that antibody. And again, you probably have learned somewhere in immunology that that's called B cell memory. That's why we give vaccination. We give vaccination so that we, long-term, the person will continue to make that group of B cells that makes that antibody against flu, flu, or, you know, name the thing we get our immunization for. Okay? That's the memory, is the regeneration of those cells. So Epstein-Barr virus has made BCL, a protein that's a BCL2 homolog, which now prevents apoptosis. In other words, makes that infected cell stem-like with it in it. Is everybody getting that? All right. And the second thing is that it makes proteins, for example, a version of a viral IL-10. So IL-10 is a interleukin which is immunosuppressive. We know IL-10's role in cancer because lots of macrophages late in cancer make IL-10 to suppress the rest of the immune system, mostly T-cell based, from attacking the tumor cell. So it's immunosuppressive. Same thing here. So this now allows that infected B cell to stay with you for the rest of your life. All right. So now let's go to, sorry, did I jump ahead too fast? So we're going to talk about HPVs, human papillomavirus. This is not even a full set of the HPVs that are, you know, that are around. Is your question here?
Yeah. I feel like this is all very complicated for a virus, but just like normally a virus just like...
So a little bit louder, sorry.
Like viruses normally infect cells and then the cell like lyses or is the virus.
It doesn't have to lyse.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
It seems much more faster and much easier than making the actual infected cell divide.
All right, that if you were a virus, that's what you would do. This is what these guys are doing. So I'm not getting into the whole virology, but you're making a very good point. Lots of viruses, and especially in the bacterial world, that we learn about earlier on in the sort of educational process, are lytic viruses. You know, phage, most phage, infect E. coli, and they lyse it, right? There are types of viruses in humans that do that. Those are causing acute infections. So we know about them because we get the sniffles and we get, you know, a subsequent immune inflammation. You know, this whole pharmaceutical industries or stuff that we take to get rid of all those symptoms. Those are often lytic viruses, plenty of those. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about what in the bacterial world would be called a lysogenic virus, which is a virus that gets into a cell and doesn't kill it. And in fact, its role as a parasite, and viruses are partially parasites, its role as a parasite to just keep itself around more and make more of itself is done by not killing the host cell, by keeping the host cell around. And in fact, immortalizing. Okay? So that cell now would have died after X number of days. Now it's in your body for the rest of your life. And so that's a mechanism of parasitism. So you're making a very good point, but that's the decision some viruses have made one way or the other, and therefore there's a difference between acute versus long-term infection. Okay? All right. So for the most part, we're talking about all the viruses. They're not acute viruses. They're not lysing anything. Yeah. Sorry, one second. Whoops. I forgot about that. Go ahead. I could put that on my exam for you guys. That's a great question. Anybody want to tackle that one? So what's the advantage of a lysogenic virus in turning it into a cancer cell? For what's its benefit for itself? That's a lytic virus.
Oh, lytic.
Lysogenic. So now it doesn't kill the cell. It now makes cancer cells. It's sort of answering the question on its own. In other words, you started with one cell you infected. You induce that cell to become abnormal so that it will have uncontrolled proliferation. And now each of the daughter cells has a copy of you. That's pretty damn parasitic, right? Now, again, don't anthropomorphize too much. This is not, you know, but this is how things have been selected over the years, that some of the viruses sustain that way. And you know, not in humans, again, we're getting into aficionado stuff, not in humans, but in fish and other species, there are cases of infectious cancer where cancer cells spread between the one individual to another because of a virus, right? We don't spread cells to each other. But in fish, there's a very famous example with something called the Spuma virus. I'm a trained virologist, so I know this is like really aficionado stuff. So Spuma virus infects walleye. Its Spuma virus is related to lentivirus, which is related to retrovirus, and infects walleye. So anybody who's fished for walleye in the winter, around here, you know, when the, you know, you drill the hole in the ice, and between drinking lots of beer, you know, once in a while you fish, you catch a walleye. Anybody who's caught a walleye in Lake Erie in the winter will tell you the following. It's full of cancerous lesions. In the summer, those lesions fall off. Why? Because the virus is actually a cold-sensitive virus. It only replicates when the fish temperature gets below a certain level. Very weird story. And then causes proliferation. You get these lesions, like papillomas, in the winter. Once that fish and the weather gets warmer, so what am I trying to say? Those cells are actually infectious to the next fish. So there are many ways that these really can act like the classic parasites.
So think of it in that term. Does that answer the question? It's a good question. I mean, this is more philosophical than biological. All right, so I'm just trying to give you some examples of look at all these different HPVs. These HPVs are different in their DNA sequence. So at the beginning, before we had a good assay for the virus replication or viral proteins, the difference was at the DNA sequencing level. And we could say you have these different DNA types. The point I want to say is that you can see some which are purely cutaneous, you know, just warts. Cutaneous. Sorry, the green one's a little bit hard for you to see. That says low risk of cancer. And then high risk. The big ones I want to talk about, which you really should know, is HPV 16. I don't see 18 here. Where's 18? I don't see 18. 31, but 16, 18, and 31 are the big players. Those types, especially 16, are probably the largest causes of cervical cancer in the U.S. Okay? And every part of the virus is almost the same. And as I said to you before, the E6 and E7 from these viruses are more cancer-causing because they avidly bind to and inhibit P53 and RP, whereas the guys from these viruses, the cutaneous guys, either don't bind at all or bind very, very weakly. Okay. So let's go over that a little bit in detail. Here's the HPV genome. It's usually written in a circular form. And the reason why is because if you start here at nucleotide 0 and you sort of go in that direction with the plasmid, and again, you see some early genes, E's, E6, E7, E1, so on and so forth, and then late genes. The late genes, L1, L2, are the ones that actually make the capsid, the physical, you know, form of the virus where the DNA goes in and after. All right. What happens? How do you get this virus? So if it's HPV 16, this is sexually transmitted. So this is what a squamous epithelium looks like in the cervix. And so what you have are basal cells. I hope everybody can see that from over there. Basal cells, which are at the base, makes sense. And then you have suprabasal cells. They're sort of growing on top of that. And then eventually you have this cornified set of squamous epithelial cells. And they make lots of collagen so as to make the surface a little bit tougher. Now, the time it takes for a basal cell to replicate and eventually make the cornified layer is a long time, months at the least, years typically. So what has been found is that somehow the virus gets into the basal level, infects the basal cells first, so the question is how does it get there? So this is typically from sexual activity, and this is like a tear, a mini tear. So the virus can get in from fluids into the tear, get down to the basal cell, and infect the basal cell. And then as these basal cells start to do their normal proliferation and so on, you start to see expression of viral genes. The E6 and E7 are in the red, okay? And what you start to see is that over time, it takes a long, long, long time, the cells, instead of making the cornified epithelium, start to grow on top of each other and make a tumor. But that process takes a decade. So at the least a decade, and the average is about 15 years. Long, 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 long time. And you can see here in the brown, the sort of late proteins that are made way up at the top. So from the time of infection to the time of cancer, takes a long, long, long time. So how do we do an experiment? How do we do an experiment on a lab animal where even in the lab animal might take like 3 years to get some product like this? It's just impossible. And as it is, human papillomaviruses don't infect animal cells. We don't have an animal model for this. So it becomes very, very difficult to show a direct cause and effect. However, when we start to look at cervical cancers in the United States and see a high level of HPV 16, now we say that it's causal. So what has this led to? This has led to vaccines such as Gardasil. So if you now can have a vaccination, so you have antibodies that are against the late proteins, which are the capsid proteins, as I mentioned. So this is what the virus-like particle looks like in Gardasil. And it's got, quadrivalent means it's got L proteins from HPV 6, 11, 16, and 18. And these virus-like particles are made in yeast, and then you get vaccinated with these things. You make nice antibodies against these things. And so this is either going to prevent infection or mediate the advance of all those things that I showed you going from the basal to the squamous layer. And so far we've done this experiment, and this is, you know, if you vaccinate, so far it's been done extensively with young women, well before their sexual activity, and then they have immunity, and the level of cervical cancer has gone down drastically. And that's led to the recommendation of now to vaccinate young men also. All right. Here's an example of a HPV-related virus. This is a papillomavirus called Schoep papillomavirus. So everybody's gone to a bar and seen this thing called, they call it jackalope. Right? No one's seen this? Like behind the bar, they always have a thing. Not everybody goes to a bar, you know. All right. This is sort of a fun thing they put up in, you know, in the back. They call it a jackalope. So rabbits don't have antlers. Where did this come from? In Australia in the 1950s, they brought in rabbits, which were not indigenous. There was nothing that was there were no animals that were natural aggressors against the rabbits, so they proliferated like crazy. They proliferated like rabbits. So what someone said is, we have this virus called Schoep papillomavirus, which only infects rabbits, and it will cause such papillomas that they will die. And when they would get infected, you would see these big papillomas being formed right over here, right? And so when they saw these pictures, someone goes, oh, that's antlers, and hence the story came of the jackalope. No such thing. Problem is, every once in a while, the rare people would somehow get infected and look at the papillomas that would be caused in them, and it's still not understood very well how very, very rare, but it would happen. All right. So now we're going to get to hepatitis viruses and HPV and HCV. They are major contributors to hepatocellular carcinoma. And as we'll talk about HBV, which you've known about for a much longer time, these are DNA viruses. Excuse me. Is associated with hepatocellular carcinoma, but at a lower level. HCV, now we're worried that it may lead to 50% of those infected may be at risk of getting hepatocellular carcinoma, which is very, very, very high. So one of the reasons why it's thought that you can get cancer is that, unlike some of the other viruses that I mentioned, they don't have large T antigen, they don't have E6, E7, they don't have things like that that are binding to P53 and RB. But they cause infections in the liver, and they cause a swelling and an immune response that causes cirrhosis. So eventually you get swelling, a bunch of the liver cells being attacked by the immune system because of a general immune inflammation. And then eventually regeneration of those cells, because the liver cells regenerate. And if this goes over cycle after cycle after cycle, we've pushed these cells, because of the regression and reproliferation, we've artificially pushed these cells into more cell cycles than they normally should go through. Okay? So, again, I want to take you aside to one of my stories that I tell all the time. If you went to a textbook in the 1880s, a medical textbook, and read what the causes of cancer was considered at the time, one of the things that they would talk about was friction. Friction. What doctors noticed is, especially among children, because children in factories was typical, in England there would be kids, you know, working in factories in jobs where they would have to do the same sort of movements, habitual movements all the time. And so they would be sort of brushing against this, brushing against this, brushing against this, back and forth. And let's say along certain parts of the hands or arms, they would get this friction all the time. What we now know is what they were doing is damage, healing, damage, healing, damage, healing. And that process of friction, as they called it, led to lots of skin or subskin cancers, dermal cancers, mostly sarcomas. So that was noticed 150 years ago. This is basically the same idea, but it's what's happening of this consistent cirrhosis and regeneration. Okay. Alright, so let me move on from that and then go to a little bit more specific. So HPV, for all those who are keeping score, is a type of DNA virus called a papillomavirus. It has a very interesting genome because it's partially double-stranded. One single strand here and then the second strand is not a full double strand. It's got a gap. And it makes some open reading phase. It's got some different gene products and so on. Again, some of them, such as this core antigen, are late proteins that make the actual capsid of the proteins. But one in some cases of cancer, HPV DNA is actually integrated to those genomes, but not always. But when you have integration of the HPV DNA, you always get activation of HTERT for some reason, and HTERT is now giving you normalization. And one of the products, this GX that's over here, that's made from the open reading frame 4, you don't have to know that. This seems to be a mild oncogene, and the way it works is as a transcription factor. So it turns on certain promoters and especially regulating mitochondrial energy function. So that's affecting calcium flux. It's also inhibiting DNA repair. And it's also pushing up the amount of ATP that's in the cell. And so that cell actually does less DNA repair, gets through the G2M checkpoint that normally your cell stops when it needs to repair, and gives you more ATP energy to get through that. Because actually ATP energy loss is another way of having a checkpoint. Is there a question? Yeah?
I'm just wondering, since there is a vaccine for HPV, why is this still such a big problem? Is it not an effective vaccine, or just not?
No, we've only been vaccinating with, for example, Gardasil for probably a decade. So that means, and it was determined that, again, this goes into a lot of detail. What epidemiologists looked at is the HPV. HPV, not oh B, HB as in hepatitis B. Why is it still a problem? So, but we're not. So we have some vaccines against it. The vaccines are not for HPV. Not as potent. So another problem with the vaccine is just because you give a vaccine doesn't mean that everybody's protected, right? The HBV vaccine is a good one, but not fully. So I can't say that, if I remember correctly, it was about 75% of the population makes a very strong immune response. 25% don't, so they need booster shots. In other words, they can still get infected and so on. There are people who don't get vaccinated. There are populations, especially in China and so on, HPV is endemic in Korea, in Japan. Lots of HPV infection. So now, if they've already had infecting lots of cells, the vaccination may help to tamper down the production of new virus, but the damage may have been done already to their infected cells. So, in other words, we're in a window right now that in 50 years, I think, if we've done very well with this vaccination, it's going to sound like polio and smallpox and stuff like that. But right now we're in a window where we've only vaccinated fractions of the populations that should be for HBV. Okay? HCV, there's no vaccine. There's a there's an antiviral treatment, set of treatments, which are very, very good. Okay? All right. So we're... Let's run along here. HCV. So HCV, again, which was discovered more recently, so it's an RNA virus, very, very different virus, and this is what it looks like. It's got these terminal repeat sequences, and then it's got two sets of genes that make RNAs very neatly. It's put all the structural genes on one side, all the early regulatory genes on the other side, and so on. And one of the reasons why HCV is thought to cause oncogenic transformation for several points. Again, the immune response, which is leading to this cirrhosis and regeneration, so that's a sort of hepatitis. That inflammation is leading to reactive oxygen species. ROS, again, you'll learn this in other classes. ROS is a suppressor of some of the checkpoints in the normal cell cycle, so that eventually you could get through those checkpoints by accumulating genetic mutations, which the normal cell would have stopped and said, let's not go further. So you have these mutations, that's one. Again, some proteins, such as some of the core proteins, which are, now I have to remember which ones they were. The core proteins are either the NS1 and NS2, I think are the big ones. I didn't write it down here, sorry. But some of the core proteins, I think it's NS1 and NS2, they also can affect mitochondrial function, and again, increase ROS, or some of them can enhance cell growth by increasing pathways. The Jung pathway is a stress pathway. So again, the cell will normally stop under circumstances of stress and damage, but if you upregulate proteins like this, Jung pathway, you can get past that. Jung is a type of MAP kinase. And again, if you upregulate cyclin D, you could get through the G1S block, and now you could proliferate. And if you gain more of these mutations, you eventually can get to hepatocellular carcinoma. Again, the take-home message is, even though these viruses are associated with it, and clearly they're causative, it is not a very quick process. This takes years and years and years, because you have to collect different mutations and so on. Let me do more time. Okay. All right, moving ahead, so Epstein-Barr virus. Epstein-Barr virus is associated with all these different cancers. There are most likely different strains of Epstein-Barr virus, and as I mentioned to you before, in the example with adenovirus, it's the same thing with Epstein-Barr virus, so nasopharyngeal carcinoma and Burkitt's lymphoma are only found in certain parts of the world. The nasopharyngeal carcinoma with Epstein-Barr virus is, again, mostly in Asia. Burkitt's lymphoma is in Africa and Western Africa. So most of the cases, one would suppose that there's a contribution to the genetic background of those populations and probably those strains of Epstein-Barr virus. So, as I showed you in an earlier slide, Epstein-Barr virus induces B-cell immortalization, that's B lymphocyte. You rarely get secondary mutations in these cells, but you get lymphoma, okay? And the way that it does it, as I mentioned to you before, is by this process of the normal B cell eventually would get to a plasma cell that spews out a lot of antibodies, specific antibody, but a very few days. But if you've infected, you have all sorts of viral proteins, LNPs, Epstein-Barr nuclear antigens, EBNAs, those sort of things. And they will now immortalize the cell so that it keeps producing more of itself, more of itself, more of itself. And eventually, if these things proliferate, it's a type of B-cell lymphoma. The good news is Epstein-Barr-associated lymphoma is easier to treat. It's not as aggressive. There's many, many different ways and here's the point I want to bring up, that in the U.S., probably 90% of us, if not more, are infected with Epstein-Barr virus, and from a young age. We have already antibodies to Epstein-Barr virus in our system from a young age. Therefore, infection cannot be the rate-limiting step. This is not like some sort of pathogen that if you get it, you get the disease, because then 90% of us in this room would be getting B-cell lymphoma. Not the case. So there must be something else having to do with that person, their susceptibility, possibly transient immune suppression. And evidence of that is that the rate of B-cell lymphoma associated with Epstein-Barr virus in HIV/AIDS patients goes up drastically. The rate of the same sort of B-cell lymphoma goes up drastically in people who've gotten organ transplants because they're treated with immunosuppressive drugs like cyclosporin. So again, it could be that this infection is ubiquitous, but other things are making those immortalized cells opportunistic. That's the main word, opportunistic. Okay? There's one point here which is an interesting point. Even though most cases we're talking about here are B-cell types of lymphoma, where Epstein-Barr virus infects, is latent, and productive in the sense of making more, possibly more virus, it can also infect epithelial cells, but there's no virus latency. So if there's no virus latency, then that might be even a lytic infection, as we're talking about. So the lytic infections may happen very, very quickly. It's thought that possibly Epstein-Barr virus associated with mononucleosis is due to a burst of virus because of infection of epithelial cells. I'm really simplifying here. So that now is a very large load of the virus, and that's why the person is very tired because they have an immune reaction. That's mono. But once they get into a B lymphocyte, it's latent. Latent. And that just happens to be the biology of those cells. All right, we're almost at the end. Here's this, what was originally called Kaplan-B sarcoma herpes virus, now it's called herpes virus number 8. Again, this is a DNA virus, it's a very large virus. The other viruses I showed you before, either RNA or DNA, are usually under 10 kilobases of information. That means they have, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 genes that they code for. HCV was a little bit bigger, it's maybe, I don't know, 10 genes, okay? But when you get to the herpes viruses, these are big, over 150 kb, some of them go to 300 kilobases. So each one of these little things, these are different genes. So they make lots of genes. And many of these genes are viral copies or viral-like gene products, which are like many of the genes that we have, that are controlling immune response. And that's one of the ways that herpes viruses get away from basically suppress inflammation, normal inflammation. Let me give you an example of that. So if this virus is infecting, and this virus loves to infect endothelial cells. So Kaplan-B sarcoma is a it was originally thought to look like a melanoma. It's dark on the skin, so most people who don't know would say, oh, it's a melanoma. But melanoma are in melanocytes, and they make melanin, which is dark brown. But the reason why these lesions are dark brownish are because they're hyperplasias of endothelial cells, and it's trapped blood, which then sort of hemolyzes, so that's brown. So it's really not a sarcoma per se, even though the original guy, this Hungarian pathologist, Kaplan, called it a sarcoma. It's not a sarcoma, it's a hyperplasia. Okay, but endothelial cells are the targets. This virus gets in, and eventually it's now upregulating COX-2, which is very much part of the prostaglandin inflammation. And so that's the normal events and signal transduction that would occur in order to have inflammation. So what's done by this virus is basically to produce proteins, for example, BP1-4, which are activating parts of this inflammatory signal, which actually goes contrary to a lot of the normal inflammation that goes on. Again, I don't want to get into that too heavily because you haven't learned a lot about the inflammatory mediators. But effectively, what it does is it leads to a different type of inflammation, which actually causes more proliferation of those endothelial cells rather than the immune system getting rid of it. So it's not a nasty lesion, but at the same time, this is it's sort of a clever way of twisting, faking the immune system to a different type of inflammation. But part and parcel of that is to produce a lot of these enzymes, the metalloproteinases that we know about in cancer, so that these endothelial cells, which normally make, you know, so why isn't this just like a little area of angiogenesis, which would be very red and very vascularized? And that's because a lot of these cells start to invade abnormally. Why? Because they produce these MMPs, which are invasion enzymes that we know about in cancer cells. So it's got some of the aspects of cancer cells, but not fully. All right. And I want to remind you of the, in the retrovirus world that we talk about, the acute versus non-acute retroviruses in the animal world. We don't have these in humans, but we, from discovering these viruses in the animal world, we discovered that the acute viruses encode oncogenes. We have versions of those oncogenes which are not mutated, unless we have carcinogens which cause those mutations. But the non-acute viruses can cause cancer by inserting their provirus, their DNA copy, upstream of an important gene, and so the long terminal repeats, which normally this one turns out to be the promoter to turn on these genes, the one at the 3' end turns out to be the one that is the poly A signal and the signal to stop making it, this, the RNA that goes from here to here. But this could also work abnormally as a promoter, that sequence, of a gene downstream in the host. And in some cases, we know of cases where even humans, there are versions of these viruses, like human HTLV 1 and 2, these are human T-cell lymphoma viruses, HTLV 1 and 2, that in certain populations, mostly in Asia, will cause very rare types of lymphomas. Not in the general human population, but they do it by inserting and turning on what could be cellular oncogenes. All right, and just to remind you that all these oncogenes that were discovered in different acute transforming viruses, we have copies of these things, but they're the unmutated form in a normal cell. All right, and so what I wanted to, but I didn't put the slide, I'm sorry, the last slide is I wanted to show you an example of, again, in certain populations where HTLV, this human T-cell lymphoma virus, has inserted upstream of the MYC oncogene. So MYC is one of those oncogenes which is not mutated in human cancers, but if it's overexpressed, that can be sufficient to give it oncogenic activity. So if you now have a strong promoter just upstream of the MYC gene in a certain cell, those cells will make more MYC, and that will become a tumor. And that's usually in T-cell lymphomas. That happens in T-cells. Okay, that's it for my... Any questions on that stuff?
A couple minutes late, sorry. No, you get to go to 5, right?
Yeah,
you
go to 5.
Oh. What about that election? No, sorry. Any questions on those? Okay. So again, I want to stress that these are, you know, good question about lytic. You know, because most of the time we think of viruses as infecting cell, kills the cell. That's the end of the story. True. This is selecting different host cells. So now, one of the ways that these viruses have adapted is now to have those cells stay around, make more copies of themselves, cause a cell to not just be immortalized, but often get cancerous, and now it's a parasite, it's made more copies of itself. If it kills the host, that's not the issue. Parasites typically make their host sick, right? But it's made more copies of itself. It's stayed around. Okay, great, thank you.